Busy show Friday, May 1st on Connecticut Today, watching the coronavirus situation. State Senate Republican leader Len Fasano joined us in the 2 o'clock hour to talk about a discussion he had recently with the governor on some of Connecticut's reopening plans. We heard from the Yankee Institute for Public Policy in Connecticut regarding the notion that state employees may forego a pay increase during the coronavirus crunch. Aaron Johnson, our buddy from the sports world, joined us to talk about still a lack of games in the coronavirus situation. We replayed a part of Governor Ned Lamont's earlier remarks in the day regarding COVID-19. And in the 5 o'clock hour, we talked to a gentleman whose son attends Southington High School. He's a senior. That gentleman, part of a grassroots group urging Governor Ned Lamont and other state officials to allow high school seniors all across the state to have some sort of graduation ceremony if it's held outside. To kick us off on the financial numbers that the state is going to be facing and that the governor freely admits is going on. State Senate Republican leader Len Fasano of North Haven, soon to be departing but still playing an active role here while he heads the caucus. Len, Paul here. How are you and the family holding up? Everything all right?
Everything is fine, Paul. How about you and yours?
Oh, I'm good. I'm in my son's old bedroom in the Wallingford Bureau here. And I'm all hunkered down. Got my call.
Wallingford is the center of the universe.
Well, I keep telling people the Earth revolves around Route 5, and people just don't they just don't get it, Len. You and I have known this. It's part of your district. Is it not? It's a truth, right?
It is the central part of my district. Yes, it is.
Yes. Well, Len, we finally got, the governor talked earlier this morning, and we're talking about a big financial bite for the state. There's controversy about that state employee raise package. We can talk about that in a bit. But I know that you're initially a little concerned here with, although the governor is sounding a little more optimistic, I know some people, including yourself, are a little still confused or wondering about the May 20th day. Talk a little about that.
So, I, within the last hour, had a conversation with the governor about the May 20th date and raising some concerns that I had with that date. And the governor and I had a very good conversation. But the bottom line is that I am concerned that the two folks who are running the reopen Connecticut, Dr. Koo, who's a very bright guy, very knowledgeable with statistics and data, and Indra, who has a terrific large corporate background and is obviously a very smart person. But we're talking about small businesses, in most cases, probably under 100 employees. And I think they've been left behind. And nothing against Target or Home Depot or Lowe's or the food stores or, keep going to BJ's, Costco. They're all opened up with significant restrictions of social isolation. But I can't imagine the smaller stores along Main Street that now we're told have to wait to May 20th can't adopt those rules that we see at the major stores and apply them to their smaller stores. There are less people. There's less congestion. There are probably more familiar faces because they're local stores. And why they can't open up next week is sort of beyond my scope. I've got concerns about that, Paul.
What was the reaction, Len, from the governor when you voiced these concerns? What did he tell you?
He understood that. I think he's open to have a discussion. He directed me to do some things, which I'm going to do this weekend and touch base over the weekend and on Monday. I also expressed the problem with outside dining. And there are a lot of problems with that. First, if you don't have outside dining, you're going to need both public health permission and certificate, which means an inspection and so forth. You need planning and zoning approval, right? Site plan, some design, some approval from the zoning officer. There's a whole bunch of administrative steps. It could take some time to do it. If you have a liquor permit, you're going to need a different liquor permit to allow that. Fenced in area if you have liquor. So you have those restrictions, coupled with the fact that I love New England, but this weather has not been the greatest. Mm. And so what are you going to do? You're going to hire staff, take them off the unemployment, say, come on, work for me. And by the way, I'm not sure if I'm going to be open every day because I'm kind of weather dependent. Even if I have a tent up, I'm going to be weather dependent because it could be too cool. And I guess I could put sides up to the tent, but that's an expense for small business. And then you put heaters in, that's an expense. So, but I may not be that crowded because people may not want to come out. Mm. And right now, if they're getting their unemployment check plus the $600 for the federal government, they're like, well, I'm getting a constant paycheck. I'm not sure now's the time I want to go back, especially if it's uncertain. So there's a lot of hurdles here that I don't think were really thought out. And I did bring those governor's attention. He thought about them and said, I understand. I didn't realize some of these. Let's have a conversation along with that and these other things. Mm. So he's open to talk. And that's very good. I think his concern is, and rightfully so, that if you have the epidemiologist out there saying you can't open up a restaurant, I think it's very bad advice. The governor is trying to do that balance of health, safety, and welfare. And if you have an expert in your dome where he's making these decisions saying, I strongly advise against it, I understand the predicament that he gets put in. I just think that the credit's not given to businesses that give me the rules and I'll comply. Just tell me however you think it is to make the people safe. Tell me the guidelines, and then I'll determine if I can meet those guidelines.
Yeah, and Len, what I do hear, something you said at the beginning of what you said there, a lot of people ask me on Facebook and ask me on the show, they simply don't understand. They say, wait a minute, I went into, not to single out Stop and Shop, but Stop and Shop, ShopRite, Aldi's, Big Y on Route 5. They say, wait a minute, the store was pretty crowded and everybody had a mask on, so why can't I go to my own, my own shop that's shut down or only allows one person in at a time? And Len, I guess the thinking is that these big stores have more space that people can spread out in. But then again, Len, I say these big stores also have more capital and they can, afford to take a hit that some of these small retailers simply can't.
No, they can't. And look, when it comes to health issues, there's that balancing act. But you can still say, look, 25% occupancy, stay 6 feet away. The Stop and Shop is large, but you wait in line to cash out, you're 6 feet away. Your liquor stores you go to, a small, medium, or large, we can do rules there. So just tell us what the rules are. Private businesses have always adopted rules. Whether you run a restaurant, you're adopting yourself to zoning and public health rules. If you're a big company, you have OSHA rules. If you have employees and they're unionized, you have union rules. So tell me what the game rules are to keep people safe, and let me do it. I went to go get takeout the other night. So it was, when you get into our parking lot, park in the back, text us. We'll let you know if the food's ready, but only allowing two people in at a time. Yeah. Government didn't have to tell them to do that. Government just set the rules, and these guys figure out how to make it happen.
Yeah, as a pizza place.
We kind of lost that perspective.
Yeah, a pizza place I went to in Hamden the other day. I called them, Len, and they said, okay, give me your card number. I gave them the card number. They said, okay, exactly. So we pulled into the front. She said, we'll call you when the food's ready. And they called me. I got out of my car. I opened the door, and there was a table right in front of the door. So I didn't even have to step in. She goes, that's yours. Thank you. I said, good. So, American ingenuity. A few more minutes with Republican State Senate Leader Len Fasano, who joins us. Len, an interesting thing has been floated, and you've probably seen the questioning, too. The governor's had a answer this question. It's coming up nationally, too. I know the governor has been asked several times over the past week about the state indemnifying businesses, providing some sort of protection if workers go back and they contract the coronavirus. And there's also questions about What if somebody doesn't want to go back? Can they be forced to go back to work? Can they apply for extended unemployment? I mean, we really are, Len, highlighted by those two questions in a place that we've really never been before here.
Yes, and, you know, there's no insurance for corona or any virus or bacteria or pathogen, either by lost profits by a business. So if you were forced to close down, you cannot make a claim on your insurance company. There's some litigation out there saying that it really wasn't coronavirus that closed us down. It was government action.
Interesting.
And therefore, we should be entitled because it's government action. And there's some interesting observations that government has a right to public health safety to do certain things, but there's compensation with respect to that.
Yeah.
So government can condemn your house to build a highway, but you get paid, you know? There's an interesting case that goes back to World War II where they, in Japanese Island, they took over a plant that was operational for a military hub, and the argument was Act of Powers because of War Powers Act, and the argument was, yeah, no, we're not arguing a right, but you got to pay, and they ended up paying. So it's an interesting situation of whether or not this is a constitutional taking issue. I haven't really done a lot of research on it, but I know there's complaints floating out there as
Len, as you know, my son works on Broadway. You know, Brian works on Broadway, and his shows got all shut down. And he was telling me, and I think this plays into what you were saying, Bill de Blasio had said, well, why don't you just go with a half house on Broadway? Average Broadway theater is about 1,000, 1,200 people, so go with 400 and 500. And all the Broadway producers, my son said, well, no, because we're going to get killed. We have to operate, you know, for what it costs to put on these shows. We have to operate at a full house. So they, according to what I've been told, because it was an order, as you mentioned, Len, a government order from Andrew Cuomo at a higher level, the insurance is covering, as you say, the insurance stepped in and they are consenting to cover a lot of these Broadway shows, which, you know, the shutdown on Broadway is costing hundreds of millions of dollars. But as was told to me by my son and some other people, that a governmental act, as you said, does kick in the compensation. So that is interesting. And then, of course, Len, the question I think you were going to follow up on is, what if folks don't want to go back to work and they still claim unemployment?
Yeah, you know, not giving legal advice as a disclaimer, but, you know, I don't know the answer to that question. I really don't. I looked at it at one point for someone, and I think it was a little bit unclear. I think that there's this Disabilities Act can come into play. There's a bunch of things, but, you know, this is nuanced issues that are coming up in the legal field. And I only pretend to be a lawyer when I'm not a state senator. And I don't want to take a guess at the outcome of this. But I think if you have a certain disability relative to pulmonary pre-existing conditions above a certain age, whatever, there may be some ability not to be forced back to work and stay in unemployment because it's contagious. Look, if they're talking about extending absentee ballots, claiming that the illness is such that the fear of getting COVID will be an excuse to absentee ballots, then it's a small step to say the state should cover unemployment if the fear of illness stops you from going to work.
Interesting. So that could be a pivot point or a reference point for that case. Interesting. Len, before we let you go, you and I have talked on the air and off, but you've said on the air, quite frankly, that the building, the Capitol, can really eat somebody up. They can really eat a newbie up. I think, Len, that despite, you know, the dangling issues here, I think the governor, for a guy that was really not really a politician, set aside, you know, some local things he did in Greenwich in that run against Joe Lieberman, I think he's done a pretty good job, Len. What do you think so far?
Look, I think Governor Lamont is a nice guy. I think in his heart and soul, he wants to do the right thing. Mm-hmm. I don't think this guy has a mean bone in his body. And, you know, I wouldn't be saying that about the former one. But this guy is not going to mean. He's not vicious at all.
He's not the porcupine, is what you're telling me.
Yeah, he's not the porcupine. And he's easy to talk to. You know, I may not agree with every decision that he's making. I may have some issues about some of the points that he's picked out for opening and not reopening. Yeah. I think he's got to be more sensitive to the business world. But he's even keeled. I would go about it differently, but, you know, everybody probably has a different take on these things. But I think he is trying his best, given the advice he's given. And whether I agree with him or disagree with him, and I do disagree with him on some things, I have to give the benefit of doubt and saying, look, this is historic. There's no playbook. Mm. You know, we talk about a budget. I know what I'm doing. I know where the triggers are. Nobody has any idea of what this, how to handle such a thing. Mm. And that's a huge issue.
Len Fasano. Len, thanks. Take care of yourself, and we'll talk down the road. Be good and be safe. Thanks, Len.
Thank you. Tell your son I said hello.
I will. Thanks, Len. Appreciate it. It's becoming increasingly evident that the state is going to have, you could say, a few financial rough spots coming post-coronavirus with the deficit ballooning to several $100 million. No one's fault. I mean, nobody saw this coming, obviously. It's tough to prepare for a pandemic, and it's good that we have the rainy day fund to help us get through this, $2.5 billion or something like that. But there are still people asking the governor to see what he can do about some of these union raises that are set to kick in momentarily or in the near future. And we welcome once again Carol Platt Leibow. She is the head of the Yankee Institute of Connecticut. Carol, hi, welcome back. And you folks issued a news release today asking the governor to handle this a certain way. Talk about that a bit, please.
Well, sure, Paul. Great to be with you and your listeners. You know, in light of these projected budget deficits, which are truly horrifying, and again, you know, no one saw the pandemic coming, but we do have some pretty substantial projected budget deficits. And we do have a long-term structural imbalance. At Yankee Institute, we really believe the only responsible course is for Governor Lamont to reopen Connecticut's existing contract with the State Employees Bargaining Agent Coalition. That's the CBAC deal. And as you know, state employee pay, health care, pensions, and retiree health care costs are just a huge part of our state budget, and it just continues to increase in cost and squeeze other really important and necessary items out of our budget. And all this is happening even as we know tax revenues are dropping, and almost 500,000 people in Connecticut are out of work.
I've already had a couple of calls on the show today, Carol, saying that you were going to be on, and at least one of the callers said, hey, you know, this is the typical right-wing Republican thing, always going after the state employees who are just, you know, fulfilling their jobs under their contract. Why should they be singled out? What would your answer to that be?
Well, here's the thing. We appreciate what state employees do, but they are not being singled out. Since 2011, Connecticut taxpayers have seen their taxes raised repeatedly, each time being promised that this will be the last time, that this is the tax increase that is going to right the ship. As a study that Yankee Institute released in 2015 and will be updating this year demonstrated, state employee compensation, on average, is between 25 and 46% higher than private sector workers doing the same jobs with the same skills and the same experience. And so there have been no cuts for state employees, And they are, we talk about shared sacrifice in our state. If there is going to be shared sacrifice, then that is really, and everyone is going to be doing their fair share, then perhaps we could at least start with Governor Lamont suspending the planned pay increase for state employees that is supposed to be happening this July. In 2018, Paul, state employees received a $2,000 bonus. In 2019, they received a 5.5% pay increase. This year, they're supposed to get another 5.5% pay increase. I don't know anyone in the private sector who is receiving these kinds of automatic bumps in pay year after year after year. And as I say, if we are really supposed to all be doing our share and we're supposed to all be having shared sacrifice, then we simply cannot continue to raise taxes on the private sector again and again and again simply to raise compensation for the public sector again and again and again.
And Carol, it doesn't mean necessarily up front that these raises will never be paid. I mean, there are other governors, Andrew Cuomo in New York, I think, Governor Northam in Virginia, who have at least called a timeout on some of their raises to perhaps see what the numbers are in a few months or to wait and see what the situation is in their state and how it shakes out. I mean, maybe something at least to that extent here.
Right, just a delay. Andrew Cuomo has done it. Ralph Northam has done it in Virginia. And we should at least try and understand just how bad the situation is before we start handing out another 5.5% pay increase to one segment of the population, while we know there are so many families across Connecticut who are struggling with unemployment and struggling simply to put food on the table.
There are people, too, Carol, and Carol Platt-Leibau is the guest, the head of the Yankee Institute. There are people who are saying, but wait a minute, Carol, this is what we have the rainy day fund for. And the rainy day fund, you know, depending upon the day, depending upon what the stock market is doing, is it about $2.5 billion? So why shouldn't we use that to, you know, plug the hole here for these union negotiated raises?
Well, once you use it, it's gone. And that doesn't address the long-term structural imbalance and the fact that even as we continue to make all the pension payments required under law, we keep on our pensions continue to be underfunded systemically, and we simply are falling further and further and further behind. And so we can plug a one-time hole with the rainy day fund, but that doesn't address the point that we continue to have made a promise to people that the way things look now, we simply will not be able to keep.
And finally, Carol, when you look at this whole thing, I think part of the frustration that does hit people when they see this, and I think people understand a freely negotiated contract must in some way, short-term or long-term, be adhered to, because if it's not, there will be court action. You and I both know that. We have seen that in this state. But, for example, in my business, in broadcast, because the coronavirus, not necessarily at our facility, but I know numerous of my friends in broadcast, in radio and television, whose shops have had to essentially say forget raises and even cut back and furlough and fire people, unfortunately, or furlough them until business picks up again. Because of this, and I think sometimes, Carolyn, you and I have talked about this in the past, people not necessarily get angry at a municipal employee for taking a freely offered contract, but as you say, it is the disparity, the kind of the two universe thing here that exists in situations like this.
Well, that's right. And it certainly isn't the individual employee's fault. They have been offered a wonderful deal and they've taken it as anyone would do. The problem is, in many cases, with government union leadership who traded a pay increase or up front for pension payments that would have kept the system solvent over the long term, mm-hmm. but wouldn't have given them the bump up front that they were looking for, number one. And the government union leaders were complicit in doing this with politicians of both parties in the past, but that's water under the bridge. And what we are looking at now is a very dire situation. And what people need to understand is that at a certain point, the money simply runs out, and the people who are most in jeopardy at that point are the government employees to whom promises have been made. And if the money simply isn't there, then it's not clear what their recourse is going to be, because you simply cannot continue, as even Governor Malloy and Governor Lamont have conceded, you simply can't continue just to raise taxes again and again and again. People leave the state, and increased taxes result in lower amounts of money actually coming in because the people who are supposed to pay them mm-hmm. simply decide to move out.
Check them out, yankeeinstitute.org, the Yankee Institute for Public Policy. The head of the institute, Carol Platt-Leibau, has been the guest. Carol, thanks. Stay safe, and we'll talk in the future. Thank you.
Thanks, Paul. Always check us out on Twitter, Facebook, and at yankeeinstitute.org.
The sports world, still confusing. We don't have anything yet, but there were a couple of pretty interesting sports things over the past week. Our sports guy, former producer of the program here, Aaron Johnson, joins us now. Aaron works with the far better-looking and cooler FM people down the hall at the Star 99.9. Ann and Raven make fun of me, don't they? Come on,
not at all. But trust me, since I've been home during the quarantine, we're probably on the same par as far as looks are concerned right now. Let's put it to you that way.
My hair is so long, it looks like I'm Jesus age, you know who.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Trust me. The barbershops have been closed, and it's been rough sledding for me.
Wait a minute now. You don't trust your sweetheart to you know, make it a little more manageable on the sides and the back, or is she not allowed to get any shears or clippers?
No. That's way too dangerous of equipment for my significant other, my lovely girlfriend, to have that close
to
my head. But
people don't understand. People don't understand. Our guys are just as bad as women. I mean, you know, we only go to our people. That's it. Like, honey, can I just get... No. Stay away.
Trust me, Paul. When I was growing up, I had the same barbershop from the time I was about 11 years old until I graduated high school. The same
Seriously.
One guy.
Seriously. It was the same thing with me and my son. Absolutely. All right. We talked last week after the first round of the NFL draft. It still looks like they want to push the season back by about 6 weeks or so, which is kind of interesting. The draft had huge numbers, 35% gain, and all three area teams, the Giants, the Jets, and the Patriots, all did some pretty interesting things.
Yeah, no, absolutely they did. I mean, whether it was Roger Goodell falling asleep or at least looking like he was falling asleep down in his basement, or having Bill Belichick's dog, I think, make the picks, at least for a couple of the Patriots picks there. All the area teams did really well. I know we talked a little bit about this last week. I know I'm personally, as a Jet fan, I can hopefully speak for you too. I like some of the things that our team did. I think the Giants did a lot of really great things, especially getting Xavier McKinney, the safety out of Alabama, in the second round, I believe. And as to the Patriots, the machine kept on rolling, if you will. Even though everyone was talking about the linebacker they took, a Division II linebacker, something tells me if Bill Belichick is taking somebody from, you know, Division II college football, the guy's going to end up, you know, getting fitted for the gold jacket in about 5 or 6 years. So I think a lot of the area teams did some great things with the draft. And whenever we have football, it's going to be interesting to see how some of these players get a jump start to their career.
Yeah, it's interesting that Patriots pick. He came from a school that I never heard of before, and they say that this guy, I think this is the safety people are talking about. This guy apparently is a physical freak as far as his ability and his first step, his burst, as you football guys talk about it.
Yeah, that's a big word that you like to hear about him, burst and It is something that when you hear of someone say burst, when you think about it, you think about somebody that's able to get off the line, outside linebacker, be able to get to rush the passer. I mean, some of the top things that coaches are looking for across the NFL, great quarterback play, great left tackle play, and outside edge rushing. I mean, it's something that our team hasn't had for years, but outside edge rushing can really make the difference in many a game, because if you can start making that quarterback be very uncomfortable, then you got a real good shot in any game you play.
The NHL says they're going to have teams start practicing in 2 weeks. The NBA, I saw this, Aaron, this was interesting. The NBA says they may finish their regular season and whole playoffs at Disney World, which I thought was kind of interesting.
I mean, it's the most magical place in the world, isn't it? I mean, can you imagine Mickey Mouse coming out trying to block LeBron James and Anthony Davis? I mean, it is the craziest things. But like I said, these are crazy times. And the NBA getting an opportunity to try and finish their league, because this is something that the NHL is, you know, akin to this too, but they were in the middle of their season. I mean, we're supposed to be smack dab in the middle of playoff season for the NBA and for the NHL. And so they're desperately trying to get something done, because, I mean, yes, the start of Major League Baseball has been postponed, but you got to expect an 162-game regular season. Normally, you're going to get some of those games played. And when you even think about the NFL has plenty of time. They're the ones that are kind of sitting back watching everything unfold because they have the time to do this. But for the NBA and the NHL, it's all hands on deck. You want to be able to get this season in. You don't want to waste, you know, guys' careers and guys' playing time, and especially, you know, the almighty dollar. You don't want to lose out on that playoff revenue that is always so good at the end of the year, especially when you have the top flight players and the top flight games going on national television.
And especially, Aaron, if no fans are going to be allowed at this game, that means whether you're a station like us and WICC that carries the Yankees in Fairfield County on radio, or the television outlets for hockey, basketball, and baseball, maybe even football, but as far as people watching and listening, I'm sure the broadcast outlets are salivating, because if you can't go to a game, the broadcast ratings, I'm guessing, will be through the roof.
It's going to be something that we haven't seen in almost a generation. Because you think back to, you know, the 1940s and 50s when all these professional sports were playing, specifically baseball, when, you know, radio was king and the newspapers were king, and you were able to get all the information that you needed from the radio stations, from the newspapers. Now you're gonna have the radio stations and the TV providers being able to do that, and you're gonna be able to watch games because there's no going to the ballpark. There's no, you know, give me some Cracker Jacks and all that. That's not gonna be a thing in 2020. Unfortunately, for at least some time. So if you think that, you know, getting an opportunity to hear our buddy John Sterling and Susan Walton with the Yankees, that's really going to be the most ideal thing, regardless of if you love the home run calls or not.
Probably the most significant story, though, Aaron, that came out the last couple of days, and you and I were talking about this, the NCAA almost out of the blue. I mean, we knew they were considering this, but trying to finalize a plan to let players market their names and images while they're in school. They can't use the NCAA logo. They can't use their team logo or the name of their team. It's solely for control of their image. And this goes back to the Ed O'Bannon case that you and I used to talk about. But this is really interesting, because as revolutionary as this idea sounds, that, you know, you could have the top four or five players from the UConn men and women, you know, out there, you know, getting advertising deals, whatever. This certainly, though, has a couple of what ifs built into it.
Absolutely. And I mean, the NCAA came out with this release on Wednesday. And I mean, they're feeling the pressure, specifically in college basketball, because you got some of the best high school talents potentially coming into college basketball that are saying, you know, let's go a different route. Let's go the G League route. Let's go play overseas. I mean, you've seen that with players like LaMelo Ball playing overseas. You've seen, and the big one was Jalen Green, the number one overall player in ESPN's 100, announcing that he's going to go into the G League. He's a potential 2021 number one overall pick. So the college basketball scene in the NCAA, they're hurting for these players, because that's what's going to put the butts in the seats, if you will. And so that is the biggest reason, I think, for this ruling, this release. Now, nothing has gone into effect. It wouldn't go into effect until the 21 2021, 2022 season, and they would still have to vote on this come January. But I think this is not a knee-jerk reaction, but we've seen California put in rules where players can make money based off of their likenesses and their images and their names and endorsements. And I think the NCAA is finally starting to come out of the dark ages into the new generation of, hey, these guys are good enough that there are other options for them to potentially play before they become a professional. And especially if the NBA is going to allow them to play in a G League, or if you can play over in Australia in that league and at 17, 16. We see this all the time in soccer, where players are teenagers and they're playing in these high-profile professional kind of ranks, semi-professional ranks, where they're getting paid. And I think the NCAA is finally starting to smell the coffee, if you will, and get into the new generation and allow these players to make some profit.
Well, should college athletes, including, you know, I guess the ones here in Connecticut, if there's an outstanding athlete, well, we know there are at UConn and Sacred Heart, Fairfield, Yale, Quinnipiac, Conn College, Wesleyan, should they be able to negotiate their own endorsement deals, even while maintaining their amateur eligibility regarding their image, their likeness, and their name? Aaron Johnson, our sports guy, of course, used to produce this program before he left me to work with people who are far better looking than me and have more hair at Star 99.9. He joins us for one more segment. Aaron, you and I have covered sports for a bunch of years. You played sports in a locker room setting. You covered sports. I covered sports in a college setting. One question you and I always ask coaches, on the record and off, a lot of times off the record's more interesting. You know, we ask them, how's the room? How's the locker room? And you and I both know how key that is and what coaches have said to the success of a team. I'm reading this NCAA plan, Aaron, and at least at this point there are no limits to it. A lot of the specifics aren't there. And somebody posted, I think it was on one of the sports sites, said, so technically, and he's asking a question, could some incoming freshman at Duke sign a $60 million deal with Gatorade? And how would those things, you think, affect the room, the locker room? I mean, are the top three girls, Gino Auriemma coaches at UConn, are they going to get new cars every year, and the other 10 girls on the roster not? I mean, it's a real Pandora's box here, I think.
It really is, and I'm glad you said that, because that's the first thought that comes to my mind when thinking about this situation, because especially in a locker room like football, where you got 50 guys, 60 guys in one locker room. And so there's going to be so many different personalities, so many different walks of life. So not everyone's going to see eye to eye on certain things. I mean, you know as well as I do, sometimes in a locker room setting, not everyone's going to see eye to eye. And so when you have the top flight player who, like you said, has a car dealership endorsement, is pulling up in a brand new car while, you know, maybe the sixth or seventh guy off the bench, or maybe like the second string quarterback or whatever it may be, is, you know, walking across campus trying to get, you know, something to eat. And so it really does open up a whole slew of things that I think the NCAA, again, has been terrified to go down this road, but they'd rather do this and deal with the consequences, I think, than lose some of the top flight athletes and see the diminishing of the sport as a whole.
Yeah, because I think the other alternative here, and I've heard from other NCAA compliance people at the schools I used to work at and cover, is paying players directly. But, you know, Aaron, the obstacle in that is, okay, if you're paying, okay, everybody on the football team gets $2,000 a month or $1,500 a month. Well, you can't just do that for the football or basketball team. The volleyball team has to get that. And no offense, but the girls' golf team has to get that. The squash team has to get that, because there are things like Title IX. So, you know, maybe they're looking at this, the NCAA is, saying, okay, you UConn players, Yale, you know, UB, Fairfield, Sacred Heart, go out and within whatever guidelines we set up, get the best deal you can and go for it.
And that's the thing. And if you try and set a flat rate, no one's going to be happy. Because, I mean, the success of certain teams is going to be higher than the success of other teams. That's just the nature of what sports is. I mean, you could look at the women's team at UConn, and you could make the argument that a lot of the women on the team should get paid more than the men's basketball team because they've been more successful.
Yeah.
I mean, if you look at Gino Auriemma's record and all the championships that have rolled through, not saying that the men haven't won championships as well, but the program that you think of when you think of UConn isn't always the men's basketball team. It's really the women's basketball team. So that was going to in itself create so many different debates and so many different issues. So doing a flat rate is beyond hard, not even just talking about, you know, the football team at Alabama compared to the soccer team or the field hockey team at Alabama. We're talking basketball to basketball, men to women. And it does. I think that the NCAA is trying to make a best case scenario with everything that's going on, but it is going to be interesting to see and fascinating to see how this all pans out, because you're not going to make everyone happy with a situation like that. You're just not, because there's too many players and there's too much money to go around. And some players that are better, I mean, Zion Williamson at Duke last year could have walked into any kind of contract that he wanted to. And who's to say that the 12th guy on the bench that's still getting water for Zion shouldn't be able to make at least some kind of money too?
Yeah, I mean, how many dealerships do you think around Duke would have run to giving him a car, or would have run to have him do an autograph? Can you imagine what an autograph signing with a guy like Zion Williamson would be at a car dealership? It would be a mom scene.
And that's the thing. These aren't professional athletes where, you know, they have some type of money already coming in. A lot of these college players are coming in a situation. I mean, you remember what it was like being in college. I remember what it was like being in college. And it's like a lot of ramen noodles, Pop-Tarts,
and mac
whatever
and cheese.
You get your hands on. And mac and cheese. Anything that can go into a microwave is what you're eating. And for these college athletes, a lot of it can be that too. Because I said, I remember covering some of these guys, and it was, we'd see them in a cafeteria, but then it's still whatever can fit into a microwave. So like you said, it would be a mob scene. I think the NCAA is trying to figure this out, and it's going to be interesting to see, because at the end of the day, like I said, not everyone's going to be happy. You're going to have some players that are going to be making more than others.
And you and I both know, Aaron, finally, you know, the best laid plans of mice and men, there will always be, no matter how many safeguards, even if you have a separate officer now at each school to watch this with a staff, there's always going to be some sleaze around with some sleazy alumni and all that stuff.
Absolutely. I mean, that's the nature of college football, or college sports, I should say, not just football. That's the nature of college sports. I mean, for as much as you would like to think it's, you know, the fight song and everything's clean and proper and amateur athletes, there's a lot of dirt that goes around. We hear about scandals all the time. So that's an area that I don't think the NCAA is thinking about. But, I mean, you got to have it in the back of your mind if you know anything about college sports, because some alumni, like you said, is going to come up with a nice $100, $500 handshake, and then it's going to all go downhill from there.
Where can I get one of those? I haven't got one of those handshakes in a while. I'm just checking. That's all.
Yeah, I need one too. Let's just put it that way. It would be nice.
Even for those working with those big FM guys now, man, I'm telling you. Aaron Johnson. Aaron, thanks. Have a happy weekend. Say hi to everyone and be good, man, okay?
Absolutely, Paul. Same to you. Take care.
We can stretch out our rainy day fund, not just for this fiscal year, but for the next fiscal year. Do it by also holding our taxpayers and holding our service providers harmless. I'm not sure we'll be able to promise a lot of new tax cuts or a lot of new spending increases, but we're going to try and do best we can, given the current situation, to hold that harmless. The next fiscal year, though, starting in July 1, does look like a $2 billion deficit, and that's plus some additional costs that are fixed. And Melissa will tell you how that drives the cost up to probably more like $2.4 billion. So, you know, if you're doing the math, you're going to see we are going to have to streamline things, make some cuts, work in collaboration with our friends in labor, work with all the different entities that provide services here, see how we can do our best to hold down those costs and stretch our dollars as best we can. I'd also tell you that along the way, we have the Special Transportation Fund. I'd say we spent a lot of time talking about the Special Transportation Fund last year. You know, we had hoped that given a gasoline fuel tax revenues, the Special Transportation Fund would, you know, at least stay solvent for another 3 or 4 years. Right now, it looks like, given the drastic cut in gasoline prices, drastic cut in revenues coming into the Special Transportation Fund with our share of the gas tax, that Special Transportation Fund probably runs out, will eat up the reserve funds by about July 1 of next year. So Maybe we can sit down with the legislature. You heard my best ideas on how to shore up our special transportation fund, and I'd love to work with you in terms of other ideas we have to shore this up. And there's not much left in the rainy day fund to play games with that as well. I just leave you with the fact before Melissa takes over that we're working hard every day. I think you're going to see some support from the federal government. How that's allocated, we'll see. You know, to date, we've gotten about $1.4 billion. And you're saying, well, man, that's pretty good. You've got $1.4 billion. What more could you need? That goes specifically just to reimburse us for COVID-related expenses. Testing expenses, healthcare overtime, a variety of things that are specifically related at the state level and at the local level. As Melissa will tell you, we're getting the ledger from the local municipal government within the next week so we can see what their expenses have been, as well. We've got a preliminary budget on what we can do with that $1.4 billion, and we're trying to make sure that plays out over the course of the next year as well. So we've got that balanced going forward. In addition, there's some money in there for education, for higher education, and there's money there for K through 12 education. And that money is being allocated right now, some of which I hope is already going to K through 12. And finally, our hospitals obviously are putting out a lot of expense, and they're not getting the revenues they used to get from so-called elective surgery. We've got distributed, I think, about $150 million, give or take, right now to the hospitals to help shore them up. I think that's about one-third of the first money dues to the hospital under the federal bill, and there's another $75 billion. So I'm hoping we'll be able to get that money to keep our hospitals together. They've been heroic, by the way, in getting through this, just like every single hospital worker and frontline responder has been. So, look, I'm sorry to ask everybody, we're going to have to do a little more, all of us, on this fiscal front, but we are getting through this just like we're getting through the COVID crisis, just like you heard yesterday, how we're slowly getting our economy going again. And in terms of clarity and certainty, you'll know when we know how things change. We'll know how fast sales tax revenue starts picking up as we open up different pieces of Main Street economy. You'll know how fast the income tax coming up. Bliss has made best estimates, conservative estimates, which we think get us through for the next fiscal year. And we'll be making updates on this on a monthly basis. Melissa?
Thank you very much, Governor. First of all, I just want to acknowledge the outstanding work of the Office of Policy and Management and the Office of Fiscal Analysis. We are required by statute to produce consensus revenue updates multiple times per year, and this is reflective of that combined effort as well as is informed by economic data from IHS consultants as well as Moody's that is used by the Office of Fiscal Analysis. As the Governor indicated, for fiscal year 2020, our latest estimate for projected shortfall is approximately $934 million. That does include revenue adjustments that are baked into the consensus revenue report that was released yesterday. Approximately $370 million of that shortfall is just the timing of receipt of federal funds based on the late approvals of our hospital settlement and the related state plan amendments that have to be validated and approved by the federal government. So the true shortfall in terms of revenue shortfall in fiscal 20 is about $570 million. And that's primarily in the areas of lower personal income taxes withholding. Obviously, we have a significant number of unemployed individuals in the state, and we immediately begin to see a reduction in income tax withholding. For the month of March alone, we saw a 3.7% reduction in withholding. And obviously, we were at the very early stages of our COVID economic impact in the state. As we are moving into fiscal year 2021, we have a budget that has been adopted and is in place that has not been amended. And that budget is a $20.2 billion budget. based on the updated consensus revenues, we project revenues of $18 billion, leaving us with a revenue shortfall of about $2.164 billion. And the areas that significantly drive that, obviously, are, again, personal income tax withholding. From an economic growth rate perspective, we're seeing about a 4.5% reduction. Our personal income tax, the estimates and finals portion, and past serenity tax, that does contain a cap. One portion of that would be the capital gains impact. We are projecting about a 26% reduction. On a positive note, those particular income sources are subject to our volatility cap. Due to the good work of our Democratic leadership and Senator Funfara, we do not budget all revenues that we anticipate to receive in a given year, so that helps to soften the impact to the budget. On sales and use tax, if we look at the industries that have been temporarily suspended, they comprise about 35% of our sales and use tax revenues. And so as we thoughtfully reopen the state for business, we do anticipate seeing those revenues begin to replenish, if you will, to prior levels. But we are projecting about a 5% reduction in growth rate. And obviously, that's reflective of the timing it takes for individuals in the state to become reemployed, the timing of the recovery and businesses reopening, as well as the extent to which consumers feel comfortable spending at prior levels. And historically, there is a little bit of a delay in the recovery to see spending increase to prior levels. Our corporation tax, obviously, the extent to which businesses feel some impact on their net income or profits, they will update their estimated payments to the state. We are projecting an approximate 14% decline in the growth rate. So what does that mean for us for fiscal 2021? As indicated, we have about a $2.164 billion revenue shortfall. Revenues will come in $2.1 billion lower than budgeted. And we have some other areas that we knew required adjustments in the midterm budget. For example, in our health care cost, about $40 million adjustment that we would have made in the midterm budget. Pension cost, just to reflect the latest numbers from our actuaries, as well as some of our entitlement programs, such as Medicaid, and the caseload trends that we're experiencing. And so there is a known amount of adjustments that would have been required to this budget. That is about $164 million. When you take the revenue shortfall and some of those expenses that will come in higher, we project a $2.3 billion deficit early estimate for fiscal year 2021. Obviously, as reported for fiscal year 20, we will by and large depend on the rainy day fund to cover the fiscal 20 shortfall. We estimate closing the fiscal year with an approximate $1.9 billion rainy day fund. We are very fortunate here in Connecticut for the foresight of prior leaders, as well as the diligence of our current governor in protecting the rainy day fund. We have one of the highest rainy day funds in the nation at 13% of general fund revenues, and that's helped us not only weather the storm in fiscal 2021 as anticipated, but also helped us with our cash position as we're seeing slower revenue coming in because we've given businesses more time to pay their taxes, and where possible, we've expedited payments, for example, to our municipalities. With that being said, however, with a $2.3 billion estimated deficit, we will require some additional mitigation in order to close the fiscal year in balance. And we are just beginning to establish a framework for that mitigation. We will be doing so in partnership with our appropriations and finance and revenue chairs. And the soft edges of that plan, if you will, would include some amount of revenue changes, which will be essentially holding revenues flat, and where there might have been some opportunity to give additional tax relief, we will likely be proposing to hold the line on those types of changes. We estimate about $100 million in revenue changes. We also estimate about $415 million in rescission and other deficit mitigation measures. The governor does have 5% rescission decision authority and statute, and any reductions above and beyond that would require legislative action. With those measures, we will be attempting to reduce the shortfall to $1.8 billion to allow us to be able to utilize the remaining budget reserve fund balance. I will note the following. Obviously, these are estimates. We will not know how we close the fiscal year 20 budget until August and September, and our true best first estimate for fiscal year 21 will be in November. Obviously, expenses can change. They can go up or go down, as well as revenue. So this will be a plan that continues to evolve. With respect to our special transportation fund, as the governor indicated, we also started the COVID downturn, if you will, with a really strong starting balance, 20% of the transportation fund appropriations in reserves. We do anticipate over fiscal 20 and fiscal 21 fully drawing down on those reserves, and that's due to decline in motor fuels taxes. Obviously, a lot of individuals are not driving into work, and we have very low motor fuel pricing right now, and that we're seeing the same thing in the oil company's tax with respect to diesel fuel prices. That being said, the challenges we have in the transportation fund, we will have to confront them, and we'll have to confront them as early as approximately a year from now. I will say the following, that our federal government has been very swift in implementing significant measures to help with the economic decline. Obviously, stimulus payments have gone out to individuals to help stabilize their finances. That should stimulate some spending in the economy. The $600 unemployment bonus has started going out to the unemployed, and all of the stimulus funds that we've received, had they not been provided, the shortfalls would be much more significant. So in summary, our rainy day fund will be a major support in 2021. Connecticut is well positioned and one of the highest in the nation with that rainy day fund. We do believe that the rainy day fund will be inadequate. On a positive note, economists estimate that our recovery will begin as early as 2022, that this will be a swift downturn and we will begin to grow. However, we will need to look at additional mitigation to support our budgetary needs as Connecticut reopens and recovers. And as we've seen in prior downturns, it does take multiple years for our revenues to actually return to prior levels. But the governor has tasked the agency to work with our probes and financiers on a plan, and this is the beginning of that discussion.
There is a new website out there. You may have read about this, and I wanted to get these folks on here. Because of social distancing or some of the restrictions still in place because of the COVID-19 pandemic, high school graduations are still in doubt as to whether or not they're going to be allowed. Now, presently, I guess they would not be under the governor's edict here. So go to the website, ct2020highschoolgrads.com. That's a plural. So ct2020highschoolgrads.com. They have a Facebook page, too. And you can see the big banner there, CT High School Class of 2020, one class, one graduation, and one playbook. They have written the governor, and they say, listen, we have a plan here. We think this will work. To not do it next week or the week after, but to do it maybe a month or two down the line and allow the 41,000 or so Connecticut high school seniors to attend graduation with a couple of guests if they want to. Michael Gaudio joins us right now. He is affiliated with that group. Michael, hi, it's Paul at WICC. How are you?
I'm doing well, Paul. Hey, thanks for having me on.
No problem. How did you get affiliated, and do you have a son or a daughter who is looking at the possibility, Michael, of, or do you know anybody looking at the possibility of not having a formal graduation this year?
I do. So my son is a senior at Southington High School, mm-hmm. and he's worked very hard, you know, over the last 13 years, and is looking forward to having his graduation. So many things have been taken away from all these senior high schoolers this year, and we thought the governor has so much on his plate. He's been hearing from so many different municipalities on hundreds of different ways to do this. We sat down with numerous parents and said, let's put together a simple plan that would make sense, make it safe, and these kids can still have the graduation that they will remember for many, many years to come.
Yeah, you know, Michael, I was talking about this yesterday a little bit, and you always get those stragglers. I had friends of mine in college that weren't into graduation, even though we've stayed in touch. Every high school, you get one or two kids who don't go, whatever. But 99% of grads want this to happen. It's the culmination, as you say, of a long, arduous task for, you know, many kids in high school. I still keep in contact with, you know, a lot of my high school friends. So I think a lot of people, they may have poo-pooed this at the beginning, but I think when they think about it, Michael, I think upon, as they say, upon further review, I think you have a valid case here.
I think we do. You know, luckily yesterday the governor is starting to open up the state a little bit, you know, and on May 20th, he's opening up some more things, and he's got his phase one, phase two. And I'm sure that he has something in mind for the high school graduates. The issues I think that we're hearing is that a lot of municipalities are having their ideas in multiple different ways. Who wants to have it via Zoom? You know, who wants to have it where it's a drive-by through a parking lot? I think you lose a lot, you know, and I think if certain things are starting to open up and if we have a plan in place that will maintain social distance, maintain safety for everyone involved and reduce the amount of people in attendance, it should only be done in an outdoor place. Mm-hmm. We think that the students can still have it. They can still have a day that they can remember late in June. That will be something they will remember. So, again, our playbook, you know, as you mentioned at the beginning when you introduced me here, we do have a playbook that we put together. Okay. And I think the playbook is simple, it's easy. And I think the governor and the state of Connecticut could feel rest assured that if every municipality follows this the same way, then there's going to be consistency, there'll be safety, and the risk of the coronavirus being spread will be very minimal.
Okay, we'll get to your proposed dates momentarily because this is not something for next week or the week after. You've projected this out a couple of months. But, Michael, go over the plan for people who haven't read about this. I think you folks have a very interesting plan. You seem to have covered it all. Give us some of the points here that you have presented in the media here and you forwarded to the governor. What are your ideas for doing this?
Sure, thank you. Again, I'll just highlight a few of them. But again, most importantly is the event should be held outside. So we're proposing the week of June 22nd, and you do it on a Monday. And every subsequent day, consecutive day, would be the rain day. So if it rains on Monday, we'd have it on Tuesday, Wednesday, et cetera. Held outside, only two members of the family would be allowed to come. Again, the two parents, that would be it. What we're proposing is, again, we will have people at all entrances of these football fields or municipal parks where they would be checking everyone's temperature at the checkpoints when they're entering. Everyone would have to wear a face mask. Everybody would receive a hand sanitizer at the gate. The seats would all be 6 or 7 feet apart throughout the field, as well as in the bleachers. So everything that we can do to keep everyone far apart, but also have it in person and then call the students up one by one. For the family members that cannot attend, again, grandparents and siblings, you know, we feel that each town should be required to live stream the ceremony for family members so they can go ahead and view it online. You know, we would have parents stationed throughout the parking lots because, again, we don't want any congregation. You know, again, the students would have to understand they would have to follow this. You know what? I give a lot of credit to all these senior kids. You know, as I'm driving around or running to the grocery store, you don't see anybody out. I think everyone is adhering. Everyone is nervous. Everyone is following the protocol. And if these kids can have this one day to celebrate what they've done for so many years, I think this would all go very, very smoothly. You know, it's well thought out. You know, the governor heard about it. You know, he made a quick mention on it on his newscast at the beginning of the week. And, you know, his thing, he thought it was interesting. And he said this might be an ingenious way to allow some young people to do it. And I think what we like about it is if everyone's doing it the same way, then it can be controlled. If you're going to have right now 169 towns doing things differently, there's a higher risk of something happening and going wrong.
Interesting. Michael Gaudio is the guest. And Michael, you said Monday, June 22nd, but I know you've also said if the numbers aren't where the governor wants it yet for cases and hospitalizations, really, time-wise, be a little hot out there in caps and gowns. But you said you could carry this idea almost until the end of July before kids have to go to college and even before, you know, maybe they go on vacation or whatever. But you have left yourself some wiggle room here.
Absolutely. And I think you need to, because, you know, we have right now over 120 towns, you know, in Connecticut already that we have representation from different people. We're also receiving inquiries from the state of Georgia, Massachusetts, New Jersey, and Tennessee. So this is really picking up steam. I think, again, the governor wants to do this. It's just they have so much on their plate. And if we keep it simple and everyone follows and it's done one way, we really believe it can be done. These kids have lost so much this year, you know, from the prom, the field trips, the sports, the class day, scholarship nights. You know, you can only do so much on Zoom. You know, I Zoom every day in my industry. But again, you lose a lot of it. They're all going to be going away to college. You know, this is step one. I'm hoping the governor really takes this to heart. And that way there, if he endorses it, hopefully the municipalities, you know, will do the same thing and we can get this to go forward. So we're really excited, you know, and the more we can get this out and you know, a grassroots effort, I think that this can come to fruition and we can have it and do something special for all these kids.
All right. Joining Michael Gaudio for a few more minutes here. Michael has a son who is a senior at Southington High School. Michael is part of a group of parents and loved ones of high school seniors, 41,000 plus of them this year in Connecticut, who may, depending upon how the coronavirus pandemic tails off, and it will, but who knows how fast, who may not have a chance for a graduation ceremony. So they have set up the webpage, ct2020highschoolgrads.com. They've authored a letter and have a way that you could forward it to Governor Ned Lamont, Lieutenant Governor Susan Bicewicz, Miguel Cardona, Dr. Cardona, the Department of Education Commissioner, the Governor's Chief of Staff, Paul Mounds, and more. So you can go to that website and check it out. Michael, I don't know whether you've gotten any input from people on this part of it, but I'm wondering if there are concerns that have been voiced by maybe folks among your group, lawyers or town attorneys, regarding liability here. Or is it the kind of thing where you're hoping that people realize what the general atmosphere is if you do this?
A very good question. With the liability, again, they're thinking of having it regardless. It's just a matter of the format that they're going to have it. So what we're trying to do is have it standardized. So that way there, all precautions are being taken to reduce that. What we also thought is that there will be a registration. Every student and parent in attendance would have to sign the registration affidavit, agreeing to maintain social distancing at the event, wearing a mask, et cetera, and sort of use it as a basic waiver in regards to the corona and not to hold the municipality or the school system liable. You know, I think now, you know, as things open up, I mean, this is really going to open up a can of worms. With restaurants opening, you're going to have dinner outside, outdoor dining. You know, you might get corona from passerby on the sidewalk. Mm-hmm. You know, I think you have to assume your own risk here if you're going to do that. No different than if you're going to assume the risk in going shopping now when the stores open up on May 20th. So hopefully that will not be a big factor.
What are you hearing from your son and other high school kids you know, maybe some of his friends? What are they saying about this whole thing? You think they would be really, really bummed out and upset if they couldn't have any sort of kind of an organized get together before they graduate?
Absolutely. Absolutely. What's interesting, you know, my son plays sports, and so he's not having a baseball season this year or the field trips, et cetera. And he said, you know what? I'm okay with that. He said, I've played sports my entire life. I'm okay. You know, I went to the junior prom last year. I'm upset not going to the senior prom, but I'm okay with that as well. He says, but the only thing I really want is I want to have graduation. I want to go there. I want to celebrate. I've received my diploma. I've worked very hard. You know, and that's what a lot of kids are saying. I got to say, they're all maturing. A lot of these seniors, I think they all want the graduation. They know they've lost the sports and all the field trips and et cetera. They're just getting ready, you know, for college next year. And again, as we know, that's another unknown, whether these universities will open up and these kids can go on campus. So you know, as things are starting to open up, as the weather is getting warmer, as the numbers are starting to decline, I think the timing of a graduation at the end of June, early July, is probably the best time to do it. So I think if we all follow, you know, the advice, you know, of the CDC, of the governor, and we all do things the right way, they can have this one day. Another thing that we came up with that I was talking to the committee about is they're going to lose out on their prom this year. I said, but what do all the college kids do when they get back from school every year on Thanksgiving, right? They're all going out, catching up with friends. It's sort of a reunion. Why don't we just have a reunion prom next year? They all get out of college. And let's have a reunion prom. They can still have the money is in the budget. They all have the class dues there. But maybe rather than doing it this year, next year they can still have it, and they all can get together and talk about their first year of college as well as this whole ordeal that we're going through now. So there's a lot of good ideas on the table for many different volunteers.
Michael, thank you. I wish you folks luck. We're going to stay in touch on this, on both the graduation and the prom thing. Folks, the website, they're on Facebook too, but the website actually has some of the facsimile of the letter that you can forward to the governor, the lieutenant governor, the commissioner of education, the governor's chief of staff, Paul Mounds. It's CT2020 High School Grads, plural, CT2020 High School Grads. .com. Michael Gaudio. Mike, thanks. We appreciate it. We'll be in touch.
Hey, Paul, thank you. Have a good day.
Appreciate it, my friend. Thank you.